Ingrid, yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Fingerette, and I represent Dorothy and Artie McFerrin. I'd like to make 4 points when it comes to the R&D tax credits that the McFerrins filed in 2003 for the 99 tax year. To run through them, give you an overview, the first 2 points deal with the fact that the absolute wrong legal standard was applied for 2 of the 4 basic elements to prove that a company's doing research and development for the tax code. The first one is that the court applied what's called the discovery rule. And the second point is that they applied the wrong legal standard when it comes to the definition of uncertainty. Third point, I'd like to address the fact that the government has asked the court to...
Now, what about, I thought process of experimentation was one of them, or is that another way of stating one of the ones that you...
Yes, the legal definition for uncertainty falls within the definition of process of experimentation, okay. The Treasury regulation. You're correct, Your Honor. The third point I want to make my way to is the fact that the government has asked this court to ignore the fact that bad law has been used and affirm this judgment based upon substantiation. As this court has previously held in the GM trading case, findings of fact that are influenced by an erroneous view of law are entitled to no deference. Not only were these facts influenced, they were actually based on this wrong law. And whether or not qualified research is being conducted is a threshold question you must pass before we even get to the substantiation issue. Fourth point I would like to address is the fact that the Justice Department never even pled or intended to plead a cause of action for substantiation. They only brought it up after they lost on summary judgment, and the court had resolved all causes of action on summary judgment. So to jump into the first point on the discovery rule, the court held that Chemco, the McFerrin's companies, must have exceeded or expanded or refined the existing principles of science in their R&D, that they must have had a high threshold of innovation or broad effect and novelty in what they were doing. They based these holdings on the Norwest, Eustace, and United Stationers cases. These cases created an insurmountable legal standard that thwarts congressional intent and are clearly no longer the law and never intended to be the law. The proposed regulations issued in 2001 clearly state that taxpayers do not have to exceed, expand, or refine the common knowledge of science. It's the exact opposite standard of what the court applied based upon what the Justice Department.
Mr. Fingerette, the government's position is no, you're wrong. You are focusing on part of the new regulation and not the entire regulation. What's your answer to that?
Well, clearly, the entire law has to be viewed properly. We are looking at the entire regulation. This point, as I'm going to get into, creates an insurmountable standard that a taxpayer can't get over. And it was never intended to be the rule of law.
One of the things about your brief that I thought was lacking is that you never describe exactly what your clients did as far as their experimentation. Would you characterize what the record reflects?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The record reflects that my client is a chemical company. You know, keep in mind, most of their R&D revolves around process development. So the company would get a product, a chemical, that they needed to produce. Okay? They would then have to develop and design a process to make tens of thousands of pounds of these chemicals. Some of these were failures. The MEADEA project was the largest project talked about during the course of the trial. They tried to develop a process where this chemical MEA would be turned into DEA, another chemical. They went through.
And that's the point. I think you just hit it on the head. Is that the type of research that is contemplated in order to receive the credit? In other words, this is a process of adaptation of, I'll use their words, you know, known principles to a particular consumer or a particular customer.
That is absolutely, positively what is envisioned. Okay. So to claim an R&D tax credit, there's basically 4 things you have to show: that there is a newer or improved business component. Business components are specifically defined as 6 different things that include process development. You must go through a process of experimentation, which is defined as an iterative trial and error process to eliminate technical uncertainties based upon hard sciences, basically. So once you go through that, that is exactly what my client was doing. My client had chemists, had chemical engineers. They were trying to develop processes to make large batches of chemicals. And they the testimony is fraught with the different problems that they had, the technical difficulties in trying to clear those hurdles.
Would you have an example of research that your client did that would have actually qualified for this kind of a benefit? I mean, you've described a failure, and then you've said that you tried, but what is an example of something that actually qualified that would merit the credit?
So my client tried to develop a process to make one of the particular chemicals. The chemical that they made was supposed to come out in a liquid form. As they were able to make it in a test tube, but as they tried to make it on a commercial scale, because of the way the chemicals were interacting on a mass basis, crystalline structures were forming within the chemical and large crystal structures were falling out of the batch. They had to continue to change the process, make material changes to how they were processing, to what chemicals they were using, to try and develop a process where they could actually make those chemicals. That
did
is one example.
Succeed?
On that particular one, I think they did. On the DEA one, they did not. They could never get a process down to make that chemical.
Well, you wouldn't get a credit for something that didn't succeed.
Yes, actually, the Treasury regulations actually say whether or not you're successful is not determinative of whether you get a credit. You know, this is a general business credit. This is a credit that businesses use in the real world. They all want to be successful. Businesses' goals are to make money. Most of the research is successful. Sometimes you have a failure. But whether or not you qualify for this credit is not determinative on whether there is success or failure, and that's specifically laid out in the Treasury regulations.
Then what's the difference between that and then a deduction? I mean, it seems to me that if you expend monies to develop something, it is clearly an expense, and that can be a deduction. Here, however, you have something different. Something that merits not only a deduction, it merits a credit. And what you're saying is that you can, but not necessarily have to be, successful and still earn a credit. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, because what the credit is doing is it's incenting companies to go out and invest in research. The R&D tax credit is the largest single benefit in the Internal Revenue Code. Congress wants companies to invest in research. The idea when it was first passed back in 1981 and the economy was in a slump just like today was to encourage companies to keep high technology here in this country despite the fact that blue-collar jobs were going overseas. And so they want people to conduct research. Whether you're successful or not wasn't that important. What was important is that we're doing it and that we're keeping
it. Is that included in the regulation? Does that say this? Whether you're successful or not?
Yes.
It's in the regulations?
It is in the regulations.
Now, with regards to, quote, research, obviously not every type of research qualifies.
That's correct? It has to be based on hard sciences.
Okay. And what is the type of research that qualifies? Because I think that's the most important question, and whether or not your development of processes qualify as coming within this regulation.
So what the Internal Revenue Code says is you must develop a new or improved business component. The term business component is specifically defined to have six parts: product, process, technique, formula, invention, or computer software. So process development, the type of development we are talking about here, is specifically defined within the Internal Revenue Code to be included.
Okay.
But for this particular product that you said qualifies as research, you'd still have to substantiate what hours you spent in this development. And the trial court found that you didn't substantiate your hours. So why should we send it back if there's nothing in the record to make this determination?
Glad you asked that, Your Honor. When you're figuring out what research and development tax credit somebody's entitled to, you have to qualify the research, then you have to quantify and substantiate it. qualification is the threshold question because it sets the scope of what you're looking at. What the government effectively did is they discredited all of the testimony that was brought forth by my client because the court believed there wasn't any qualified research. So when a third-party provider who's an expert in this area got on the stand and talked about 50 qualified projects, when we had chemists and chemical engineers get on the stand, when we had 70 boxes of documents, some estimated 250,000 pages of materials to talk about what the research was and what was going on, the trial court didn't think any of it was credible because the trial court didn't think there was qualified research at all.
So if we designate what the appropriate standards are, then it can be remanded under those standards for the district court to reassess all this. Isn't that right? I mean, we don't have to make all these decisions ourselves on appeal.
Well, certainly this court is not a finder of fact. The district court did find in her holdings that there was research going on. She just found that it did not rise to the level of qualified research. It was specifically in the court's findings of fact. And she said as she was assessing substantiation, she didn't find any substantiation to address the discovery and process of experimentation holdings. Those are the two key points that we've appealed that were based upon the wrong legal standards. So absolutely, the trial court should be a new trial to assess the facts under the correct legal standard.
And are you arguing that 2003 regulations and definitions, because the refund was issued before that, so why should you get benefit of the 2003 regulations?
Okay. The proposed regulations came out in 01 that we are relying upon. In 2003 is when my client filed the claims. My client, it is undisputed from the record, my client reviewed the regulations, relied on the regulations.
2001.
The 2001 proposed regulations. The 2001 proposed regulations specifically say in them, taxpayers may rely upon these regulations and the government will not challenge return positions that are consistent with these regulations. When they were finalized at the end of 2003 by 9104, Treasury Decision 9104, they again reiterated, we will not challenge return positions that are consistent. The discovery rule was never intended to be the law. It is not a change in the law. It was never intended to be the law. It was a judicial interpretation that came out of mainly the tax courts. And if you look at the Union Carbide case that we supplemented with last week that just came out of the tax court on March 10th, they addressed this exact point. And in the Union Carbide case, Judge Clement, those were 94, 95 tax years. Those claims were filed in 99, 2 years before the proposed regulations came out, and the tax court overruling Eustis and Norwest, the cases relied upon by the Justice Department, they specifically say that is no longer good law, and that even Union Carbide.
The IRS agreed, right?
The IRS conceded the point. That's why it's in a footnote. They didn't even contest it. It wasn't a fight. I've spent the last 3 years defending hundreds of R&D tax credit claims. This is the only one I know of where they're still fighting the discovery rule. It's just not the law.
We'll see what they say.
A bigger question to me, Your Honor, is my fourth point as to whether or not this ever should have gotten to trial at all. This was not pled, never intended to be pled by the Justice Department. It was only after losing summary judgment that this substantiation cause of action even came up. If you look at what they've argued, they've said that when we pled it, we took three words from paragraph 10 and a sentence from paragraph 17 and 18, and when the judge said at the trial court level, I don't see anything resembling a cause of action, they said, oh, well, look at the two words misrepresented facts in section 35. All of these provisions deal with causes of action that were actually determined on summary judgment. The fact of the matter is that after the court said they could proceed to trial, we went and deposed Jeff Bacon, the revenue agent, who came up for the first time and said, yeah, I only refer this to litigation for the 280C issue, that he never reviewed any substantiation, that the Justice Department and the IRS never looked at any documents or interviewed people or had any basis to file this. Now, the law is clear that prior to filing suit, the government should have some concrete and positive evidence to come forth and bring claims, and they had nothing prior to filing suit. They never looked at any substantiation. This only came up after the fact, after summary judgment, the vast majority of which was decided in the taxpayer's favor, Only then did they say, wait, wait, this is really about substantiation. We're talking about the summer of 2007. I mean, my client was highly prejudiced by the fact that they waited until the summer of 2007 to even bring this up, and then went down to the trial court and argued that, well, you can't rely on any of this testimony anymore because it's too old.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Finger. You've saved some time for rebuttal.
Yeah. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Hauser?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Bethany Hauser for the United States.
What about this question that Mr. Fingret referred to a couple of times and he closed with, and that is the question of whether the government raised the substantiation issue too late and may not have raised it even sufficiently then?
Well, I believe that the district court was correct when it decided that the issue had been raised in the initial complaint. The complaint does mention the substantiation problem based on this exact Alliant Group report. And even if the district court had been overreaching in its interpretation of the complaint, it would have been within the district court's discretion to permit the government to amend pleadings at that point. So now that the case has gone forward to trial, I don't think it's a reversible error, even if it's an error.
What about the Union Carbide decision? Does the IRS concede that the 2003 regulations also apply in this case?
We wouldn't dispute that they can apply. If they
what?
We would not dispute that they can apply.
So you concede it's 2003?
If the taxpayer could rely on 2001, or the taxpayer could rely on 2003, or the taxpayer could rely on the preceding law, I think is the state of the matter. We think that the taxpayer would have to pick one of those standards and stick with that for the entire.
Ms. Hauser, would you move the microphone just a little bit more into the middle? Thank you.
Certainly. Is that better?
That's a little bit better. Thank you.
And as we explained in our brief, we think this case can be affirmed even though the district court used the preceding standard and the taxpayers now want to rely on either the 2001 or the 2003 regulation, because the tax court, the district court here found that there were simply no records to substantiate the number of hours that worked on activities that might have constituted qualified research.
But do we know that the district court would make that same decision if we were to remand and articulate what are all the proper standards? Shouldn't the court have that opportunity?
I think that the same statement, the statement would be valid under any standard because I read the reference to activities that might have constituted qualified research as a reference to all the activities claimed by the taxpayer here. I think that, as we explained in our brief, that finding that the substantiation was just not there was amply supported by the record. The Alliant Group report has many weaknesses to it, including the fact that time worked was estimated several years after the fact. That by years after the fact, I mean the time of the Alliant Group report, not the time of trial. Supposedly by interviews with people who had done activities that were alleged to have been researched, those specific employees at trial could not recall having been involved in those interviews with either respect to them or with respect to their employees they supervised. And then also the district court pointed to the fact that the Alliant Group report just used a flat percentage for materials used in research, which the court found, and I think correctly, was just not a reliable way of explaining what materials were used in research projects.
It's your brief. Argues that most of this research was not qualified. So if most of it wasn't, that infers that some of it was. So can you quantify what was?
No.
What part of the refund was attributable to the portion that qualified?
I'm not sure where we argue most, but assuming we do, to quantify it would have to be remanded.
Did you admit that there was parts of it that did qualify in your brief?
I don't believe that we did.
I thought you said most of it. If you say most, then that means not all. So that means some did.
I believe I'm not sure what language you're referring to. There are even if these activities did constitute research, though, I think the substantiation problem would prevent a credit for them. So even if some of the activities did constitute research, if the taxpayer can't substantiate the hours spent on those qualifying activities and can't substantiate the materials used on those qualifying activities, then there's no credit available.
I thought the thrust of your brief was that these processes were not the type of research that is addressed in either the 2001 or 2003 regulations.
I think.
And I mean, what I quoted is that that the taxpayers make minor changes to establish commercial products and perform quality control tests to ensure the products were within the parameters specified by the customers were not the type of activity that comes under this credit. Now, counsel opposite says it is.
I think the position in our brief is correct. That type of quality control activity and tweaking is what the district court called it, does not come within this within the definition of qualified research, even under the 2003 regulation.
Well, then would you please articulate as best you can, what is the goal of this type of research credit? What type of research is the statute trying to address that necessitates, but gives this type of a credit, not a deduction, but a credit? What is it?
It's unusually risky research. To a certain extent, every business is taking a risk when it makes an expenditure, but many of those risks are relatively small. And
are you talking like, for instance, drugs, new drugs and stuff like that?
That would be an example. But it would only be an example if
example, sure, of course.
It would only be an example to the extent the drug was really new. Repackaging an old drug in a different dosage, for example, probably not qualify. The purpose, I think opposing counsel was addressing this, the purpose of this credit is to encourage companies to do research that would not otherwise be done because it would be so risky that it would not make sense for a business to invest resources in that kind of research. Now, obviously, that's not true of quality control activities. It's sort of the opposite of risky to make sure that the products you're delivering to your customers meet their standards. So that's why I think that the regulation emphasizes the uncertainty requirement, and the Union Carbide opinion continues to emphasize the importance of uncertainty in the matter. In a way, the process of experimentation requirement is a different way of getting at that problem, that if a taxpayer is confident enough about the little troubleshooting, tweaking techniques that they typically use, like blending different vats that have different concentrations of chemical, if they're confident in how that works, then it's not risky for them to do it in order to produce a more saleable product because they're already familiar with the process.
How about the quantification of a known product? Say, as he explained, you can develop a small quantity in a test tube, but then you need research to make a commercial quantity. Does that qualify?
If there are distinct problems with scaling up, that process may qualify, assuming that there are true uncertainties and assuming that you engage in a process of experimentation. The Union Carbide opinion discusses the process of experimentation requirement with respect to the sodium borohydride chemical that was being produced by Union Carbide. And I think that's telling because the tax court there found true uncertainty, but said because the taxpayers in Union Carbide did keep records regarding this new process they were introducing, but because they didn't engage in any serious analysis or evaluation, it wasn't a true process of experimentation.
I have not, when I went through the district court's opinion, I don't recall seeing the words true uncertainty in any part of it. Did she use that?
The district court in this case?
Yes, in this case. I mean, you use it. I mean, you're using it, of course.
I'm picking up some of the uncertainty language from Union Carbide. I'm not sure if she used the word uncertainty. Certainly not the phrase true uncertainty.
But you are suggesting to us that the test, whatever research there is, it has to have the risk of what you call, quote, true uncertainty.
I don't want to make too much of the word true there. It has to have uncertainty.
Certainty.
Yes.
And that comes from the regulation, the present the regulation that was used in this case, either the 2001 or 2003.
Uncertainty has been part of this requirement since before the 2001 regulation. It continues to be part of the 2003 regulation. I believe it's part of the 2001 proposed regulation. Uncertainty. I believe, actually, in the 2003 regulation, it's found both in paragraph A3 and in the in the discovery test in paragraph A3 and in paragraph A5 in the process of experimentation. Because, again, the whole point of this is to reward companies or to reduce the risk to companies.
It makes sense to me what you're saying, but it is, you know, from – what definition are you going to use? How do you apply it to this, you know, to this case? Why is it? Why does it come within that definition or not? And that, to me, is kind of the at least my thought processes in trying to decipher this. I'm trying to. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
In addition to discussing, I think we've discuss the major issues on appeal, I'd also like to just mention in the taxpayer's reply brief, they suggest that the government should have taken a cross appeal in order to retain our victories on the issue of the timely filing of the SC terminals return and the computation under 41A instead of 280CC3. Because we won this entire case, the government was not in a position to take a cross appeal, and we believe that since taxpayers have not objected to those findings and holdings by the district court, that we are entitled to collect to recover at least that amount of the refund, regardless of the result on the main issues in this case.
I know, of course, that your position is that there was no reversible error here and that we should affirm. Going beyond the question of whether there was reversible error, in the government's view, looking at the case with the benefit of hindsight, did the district court commit any errors of law in its analysis, whether reversible or not?
In its analysis on the definition of qualified research?
Any errors at all in its analysis of the law? Any errors of law at all? Or was it 100% correct in its analysis of the law?
With respect to the definition of qualified research, Your Honor, it's difficult for me to answer that question because the government does not dispute that the taxpayers may rely on the 2001 or 2003 regulation. But because the effective dates of because the 2001 regulation was never more than a proposed regulation and the 2003 regulation has an effective date that's later, it's difficult for me to say that the district court was wrong to not apply those. But I want to say that while at the same time not disputing that the taxpayers may do so. I just don't think I can tell the district court it was wrong to rely on the earlier law.
Anything else?
No.
All right, thank you, Ms. Hauser.
Thank you.
Mr. Fingred, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, for the first time, the government stood up here and said that we had every right to rely upon the 2001 regs. The laws applied by the district court was
not. Which regulation is Which regulation did you rely on in front of the district court?
The 2001 proposed regulations that were final, the final regs are the same.
Well, what do you rely on here? 2001?
01 and 03 are the same. So when the study was done and the credits were claimed, the 01 regs were reviewed and relied upon at the time of trial. We, of course, told the court in our pretrial briefs to use the 01 regulations, which were finalized in 03. They're exactly the same. We didn't draw a distinction.
Go ahead.
Okay. Obviously, the laws relied upon by the court with regard to the discovery rule was that my client had to expand, exceed, or refine the common knowledge of science. And that's not what the regs said. They said the exact opposite. My client does not have to exceed, expand, or refine the common knowledge of science. Second of all, with regard to the effective date, again, the 01 regs say that taxpayers may rely upon them and that the Treasury Department will not challenge return positions that are consistent with those regulations. And when they were finalized in 03, it specifically again says, yes, the effective date is for years after 2003, but the IRS will not challenge return positions consistent with these regulations, even for prior years. And that's why it was conceded by the IRS and UCC. That's why it's not the rule of law that is used in any cases going on in the country right now. Treasury has admitted that's not the law through the proposed regs and final regs. Congress, in its committee reports, has said that the discovery rule is not the law.
I think we can go beyond that. I mean, I think everyone's in agreement on that.
Thank you.
Do you have anything else that you want to cover in rebuttal?
Counsel also said that the goal of R&D is to do research that would not otherwise be done. That is not true. That is not what the goal of this credit is. There is a 174 deduction for research. The credit is to increase research activities. That's even what it's called. It's called the credit for increasing research and experimentation. They want to continue to encourage companies to not only continue doing the research they're doing, but expand to do more research to keep high-tech jobs, technical jobs, here in this country. My law partner, Dean Zerbe, when he was on Senate Finance, wrote this law. I know what the intent is, and it's not to do research that wouldn't otherwise be done. It should also be noted that, to follow up on some of your questions, Judge Clement, the burden of proof here, this is an erroneous refund case. It's on the government. It is the government's burden not only to prove that my client wasn't entitled to this credit, but the exact amount. And as counsel said, they couldn't do that, and they couldn't make that distinction. The only remedy that is right for my client here is to get a new trial based upon the right law. That is the only fair remedy. There should be no dispute at this point that the wrong law was used. And the judge, even at one point in the trial, stopped evidence from being presented on the MEADEA project, the biggest project that my client had ongoing in the 1999 tax year. And the court said, all right, I don't want to hear any more on it. So there's additional evidence that needs to be presented to complete the evidence presented on that project. A new trial is the only remedy that is fair for my client here. With regard to the UCC case and uncertainty, in the Union Carbide case, the tax court, again, on this uncertainty point, said even if Union Carbide was certain of their capability to use UCATJ, one of their chemicals, commercially, it still qualified as research because the taxpayer was uncertain as to the appropriate design. This is a great example of where in Union Carbide they were developing processes, just like my client is. I mean, the case has amazing parallels. They are a chemical company developing chemical processes. One of the big distinctions that I see here is that Union Carbide is, of course, huge, very big company, making billions and billions of dollars a year. My client is a small to mid-sized company that the IRS and DOJ are coming after and applying wrong legal standards to. If there's no more questions.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fingret.
Thank you.
The case is under submission. Last case for today.